Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by Menlo Park Dental Excellence, providing general dentistry with quality care to all patients, serving patients one at a time with no triple booking, flexible hours Monday through Saturdays, mpdentalexcellence.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, 1 month into a prison hunger strike, neither inmates nor state officials are backing down. So what's the end game? Plus, in Malibu, public beaches with very little public access. There's an app for that.
Our coastline is public property and not to be used by the few, but to be used by the masses.
Also, how an art school is creating children's books in hopes of reducing gun violence. And it might just be the best collection of Asian cuisine this side of the Pacific, all at a Southern California racetrack.
I think it's very intimidating for non-Asians to come to this area and order things and try out all the great restaurants and food. So, you know, we hope that this event could kind of be a bridge for that.
It's the California Report. And we begin today with trouble in California's Department of Corrections. 1 month after first refusing food, about 150 inmates are continuing their hunger strike at several state prisons. Corrections officials say the action won't change anything, adding that the inmates are being pressured to starve themselves by violent prison gang members. It's just one of several challenging issues facing the California Department of Corrections. Reporter Michael Montgomery with the Center for Investigative Reporting and KQED is here to take us through the latest developments. And first of all, Michael, if you would kind of remind us who these inmates are and what they're demanding.
Well, the demands center on these units that are known as security housing units. These are stark, largely windowless cells where California houses men deemed the worst of the worst. Most of these men are accused of being in violent prison gangs. Some of the men have been there for decades when we're talking about Pelican Bay State Prison in Crescent City. Advocates who are suing the Department of Corrections as well as the hunger strikers say that the conditions are unconstitutional, that the kind of isolation these men are exposed to inflicts serious psychological and physical damage.
And there have been some scattered protests throughout the state, some of them outside of prisons. What are those protesters saying?
The protesters, some of whom are family members of the men in these units, others are advocacy groups, are essentially saying that long-term isolation, what they call long-term solitary confinement, amounts to torture. That is their sort of mantra, and they are calling on the Department of Corrections to place limits on the amount of time any inmate can be held in one of these units. They also want an easing of restrictions, more access to families and rehabilitation programs.
Of course, these men are in isolation. Very few people get to see them, but they do have attorneys representing them. Are any of them speaking out?
Well, very few people get to see them, and I want to add that the Department of Corrections has not allowed the media in to see any of these hunger strikers or to interview them on tape. We did speak with an attorney, Ann Wiles. She's representing inmates in this federal lawsuit. She, this week, visited Pelican Bay and was actually able to meet with the four hunger strike leaders, and we talked to her about that.
They're extraordinarily upbeat, high energy, intellectually focused. They're absolutely committed to not end this hunger strike until their demands are met. But so far, there's no breakthrough. The men are really, like I say, committed to die.
And so, Michael Montgomery, a lot of defiance on both sides here.
That's right. The Department of Corrections, as you noted, has branded these men as dangerous prison gang leaders. They are not in any mood to negotiate. And the men are not showing any signs of giving up their demands.
And as you say, the Department of Corrections characterizes these men as the worst of the worst. And that characterization got sort of a boost this week, didn't it?
corrections officials have been trumpeting the unsealing of two indictments. These were announced earlier this week in Los Angeles. And they involve the Mexican Mafia, which is one of these California prison gangs, and various cartel operatives from Mexico who were trying to form an alliance to traffic methamphetamines in Los Angeles. What's interesting is one of the indictments concerns a Los Angeles prison gang known as Florencia 13. This is a gang that has been involved in lots of violence in the streets of L.A., and allegedly the leaders of this gang are in Pelican Bay State Prison in the security housing unit. We heard from Andre Barad, who's the U.S. Attorney for Los Angeles.
According to the indictment, Florencia 13 is controlled by two Mexican Mafia members who direct the gang's activities from inside state prison cells. And they receive payments directly from the gang's drug sales.
Now, one of the men the U.S. attorney was referring to is none other than Arturo Castellanos, who is one of the four hunger strike leaders. This certainly raises questions about Castellanos, his motivations. If indeed it's true that he's been involved in an active criminal conspiracy, possibly conspiring with Mexican drug cartels, those are very serious allegations. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about that from the Department of Corrections.
Moving on to another issue, Michael, prison overcrowding. This has been lingering for decades in California. The governor and the Department of Corrections now under order from the U.S. Supreme Court a second time to reduce the inmate population by 9 or 10,000 inmates. How soon now is that going to happen?
The Brown administration continues to lose every battle in the courts. The Supreme Court refused to delay an order requiring the state to shed another 9,000 inmates by the end of the year. Now we're finally hearing talk of some kind of move which would essentially relocate these inmates to jails, private prisons in state, private prisons out of state. There's certainly indications that lawmakers will support the governor on this. The big question is going to be the cost. California right now houses 9,000 inmates in private out-of-state facilities at a cost of about $320 million a year. So we are talking tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to deal with the last bit of this overcrowding. But still, the state has not said exactly how much it's going to cost.
Michael Montgomery with the Center for Investigative Reporting and KQED. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
Malibu has some of the most picturesque parts of the California coast, but its public beaches are barricaded by private development, keeping them essentially walled off for the rich and famous who live there. But now a team of public access activists is showing people how to enjoy the beaches that their tax dollars pay for. As Caitlin Esch explains, they're using a new smartphone app.
It's a beautiful day in Malibu, and Richard Mendoza is lying out on an empty beach with his friends in front of a sprawling mansion.
It's kind of like your own private beach. You don't have a lot of people walking out. You can do, you know, basically what you want.
Mendoza is from Glendale, about an hour inland, and until recently, he never would have set foot on one of these beaches.
We thought it was just private, so we wouldn't even, you know, go for it, I should say. But now we know the app, you know, the app was useful for sure.
Mendoza is one of thousands of iPhone users who've downloaded an app called Our Malibu Beaches. It painstakingly charts all the public access points and tells you, house by house, which parts of the sandy beach are private and which are public. Of Malibu's 27 miles of coast, 20 are lined with private development. And until recently, they functioned largely as private beaches. App co-creator Jenny Price aims to change that.
So I feel incredibly strongly that public spaces are enormously important to healthy society, to democracy, to healthy communities.
Of course, not everyone feels that way. On a recent Saturday, Price, app co-creator Ben Adair, and a group of supporters met up for a small party on one of the beaches. They set up a tent for shade and a table for snacks and were quickly made to feel unwelcome by security guards and residents in a nearby mansion.
And they sort of like looked down at us, and before we knew it, they were blasting music super loud.
You know, every single day I pick up probably 30 to 50 cigarette butts, and it grosses me out.
Andy Stern is a realtor in Malibu, and he lives right near the coast. He says he's seen people urinate on the beach and set off illegal fireworks. He doesn't like it, but he believes Malibu residents are friendly to tourists.
But I've never understood the sort of thesis that Malibu isn't very visitor-serving and welcoming to the beach population.
There's no organized opposition to the app, but the creators have gotten plenty of angry emails, and every article brings a cascade of comments, both in support and opposition. Still, Adair and Price say demand for access info is strong. More than 22,000 people have downloaded the iPhone version, and it will be available on Androids later this summer. On a recent Monday, I met Price at the entryway to Carbon Beach, nicknamed Billionaire's Beach, to test out the product.
This accessway opened only after a very long, extremely contentious legal battle with one of the big Hollywood moguls.
Just finding a way onto the beach is hard. The access points are not well marked. Phony no parking signs and orange cones line the sidewalks. Price points out another trick, fake garage doors.
If you look at them really, really closely, it doesn't open. It's just designed to look like a garage door so that nobody will park here.
In California, there's no such thing as a totally private beach. The public can go anywhere up to the mean high tide line or the wet sand mark. And some houses have easements or stretches of sand beyond the high tide line that the public can also use.
So, for example, this house right here, I hesitate to call it a house. It's more like an art museum. This is three lots that they put together. You can use all the dry sand. You can go right up to the porch.
Our Malibu Beaches gives house-by-house architectural and access information pulled from the records of the California Coastal Commission, the only agency that keeps the data. Coastal Access Program Manager Linda Lachlan says the commission is looking to create apps for beaches up and down California, given the success the app has had in Malibu.
That's for 27 miles of coastline. We're talking the California coastline has 1,300 miles. So we know there's demand for an app, and so we are going to meet that demand.
Lachlan says other places with public access issues, like Mendocino County, could benefit from easy-to-use mobile maps. Jeff Williams is the co-president of the Black Surfers Collective. He's been surfing up the coast from Billionaire's Beach for years, but he never knew he could actually go there.
Our coastline is public property and not to be used by the few, but to be used by the masses.
Williams has an Android phone. He says he'll download the app as soon as it's available so he can bring his wife and daughter to the beach. For the California Report, I'm Caitlin Esch in Malibu.
The Art Center College of Design in Pasadena has an international reputation for graduating hotshot illustrators and car designers. But it recently aimed its creative energies at something very different, gun violence. The institution published a series of children's books that illustrate what a gun-free world could look like. From KPCC, Adolfo Guzman-Lopez reports.
One of the books is titled Amos's New Life.
Amos the Bullet was born in a cold place called the Gun. One day, somebody shot the gun. Bang. Swoosh.
At first, Amos breaks things, but when he meets useful objects like pencils and lipsticks, he decides he wants to be more like them. The book is one of four published by Art Center College of Design in an effort called Uncool, the Anti-Gun Violence Project.
Hi, guys. So nice to see you all here today. Thank you so much.
On a recent afternoon, Art Center's Helen Kang talks to two dozen elementary school-age kids sitting in folding chairs in a sunny spot outside a North Pasadena public library. She leads a reading of Zormax 133's Big Question, the last of four events to get the word out about the series of books.
One day, Zormax 133 landed on Earth with his scanner device. He scanned three objects, a mouse, a flower, and a gun. Oh, a mouse is cool, and a flower is cool, but what about the gun? Why does my scanner just have a question mark?
Zormax 133 has a toothy smile, a big blue head, and a little red hat. He talks to a chemist, a snowman, and a grandmother who do cool things and think guns are uncool. After the reading, kids used acrylic paints to make posters of cool things in their lives. Kang says the books are part of an initiative that teaches Art Center students how to use their design skills for social change.
The goal of this class was to address the issue of gun violence and why children think guns are so cool at an early age and in a way that doesn't frighten them.
The project was in the works when gun violence shook the private college. Art Center professor Norman Schurman was shot and killed after an argument escalated at a party. Colleague David Tillinghast says the project is dedicated to Schurman. Tilling has class, designed, and wrote the books. He says he and the students had a hard time finding children's books on gun violence. The few books they found seemed too serious and heavy-handed. The class wanted to appeal to kids and parents in a positive way.
We had to find a way into their imagination and storytelling that didn't show guns particularly, didn't infer violence in any way, didn't show blood, didn't show murder. We had to talk about how a world without guns could be empowering for children.
Tillinghast says as early as the first grade, kids already think guns are cool. They learn it from images on television, video games, and product advertising. At the Pasadena workshop, fifth grader Christian Solorzano painted a poster of soccer balls. But at home...
I have BB guns, a machine gun that's a BB gun. I have two more pistol BB guns.
Do you have any of those Nerf gun things?
I do. No. I used to like Nerf, but I only like BB guns now.
They're more dangerous, aren't they?
I know, but they shoot faster.
Johnny Chavez, also in fifth grade, used black paint to draw the Xbox video game he got for Christmas. His favorite games?
Black Ops 2, my Batman Arkham City, and my Mortal Kombat game.
Do any of those have guns in them?
All three.
Melissa Townley brought her 6 and 9-year-old kids to the workshop. They attend private school in Pasadena.
We have talked about that. You know, Dad has used a gun for hunting, and he uses it to kill things to eat. So we've talked about it in that way, but not about, you know, I've never talked to them about anything in the media that's happened.
She likes the creative way the Zormax book used a space alien to start a conversation about whether guns are cool.
My job is to guide my children, not to, you know, tell them how things are. So kind of help them come to their own conclusions.
Arts Center College of Design received a grant to publish 1,000 copies of the books. Design professor Tillinghast says he hopes to approach New York publishers to print many more copies of the books because messages to combat gun violence aren't being heard.
Especially with the size of the NRA lobby in Washington, the power that they have, the money, and their ability to reach into all sorts of pockets and all sorts of places, you know, there isn't that messaging on the other side. And the truth is, no one's looking to squelch the other messages. Just the idea is that the other side should be heard. It should be prevalent as well in the media.
He's hoping for a happy ending, like Amos the Bullet's epiphany.
Amos learned he didn't have to break things. He could actually make things. The best thing he could make was a friend. And he couldn't wait to make many more.
Arts Center says it's publishing about 800 copies of the gun violence children's books in the next couple of months. It's also recently met with a digital publishing company that wants to turn the books into an interactive online project. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
Grammy-winning keyboardist and producer George Duke died earlier this week in Los Angeles at the age of 67. He had a long list of collaborators, ranging from Frank Zappa to Michael Jackson to Miles Davis and Cannonball Adderley. But he also released 30 albums of his own. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert has this appreciation.
Over his 40-year career, George Duke excelled at just about every musical style he turned his attention to. From straight-ahead jazz, funk, and fusion, to European classical and Brazilian music, R&B, gospel, and avant-garde rock. He wrote scores for films and TV shows, and was a wizard in the studio as an arranger and producer. When he wasn't being sampled by Kanye West or Daft Punk, he probably reached his widest audience with funk anthems like Dookie Stick, from his 1978 album, Don't Let Go. So come feel if you will the magic of the Dookie Stick. They want to play for you. Play, Baba. Hey. Born in San Rafael, Duke grew up in Marin City. While making a name for himself on the Bay Area jazz scene in the mid-60s, he studied trombone, bass, and composition at the San Francisco Conservatory, graduating in 1967. On stage and off, Duke embodied hipness, without bothering to affect a cool and detached pose. No matter what kind of piano or keyboard he played, he infused everything he touched with amused, big-hearted soul, an attitude that brought to mind his formative employer, alto sax great Cannonball Adderley. In his early 20s, Duke became a key player in the emerging jazz fusion movement, collaborating with violinist Jean-Luc Ponty, recording a seminal live album in Hollywood. Recruited by Frank Zappa, Duke gained notoriety through the intricately constructed music of the Mothers. He played a key role on classic Zappa albums like One Size Fits All, Overnight Sensation, and The Grand Wazoo, which features his lovely celestial solo on the waltz Blessed Relief. After moving to Los Angeles in the early 70s, he forged a series of deep creative relationships with equally formidable musicians, most importantly drummer Billy Cobham and bassist Stanley Clark. But by the early 80s, he was working as much as a producer as a player, scoring a chart-topping hit with A Taste of Honey's Sukiyaki. He was particularly known for his work with vocalists, and won Grammy Awards for producing albums by Natalie Cole and his cousin, Diane Reeves. All the while, Duke continued to release his own albums. One of my favorites is his symphonic Muir Woods Suite, a gorgeous work for jazz quartet and orchestra. No matter what musical direction he took, Duke maintained strong ties with the jazz world, and he was widely beloved on the scene as a teacher, mentor, and generous colleague. You can get a taste of his ingenuous personality on his website, where he wrote candid notes about all of his recordings. Duke's final album, Dreamweaver, came out on July 16th, and it covers a lot of the musical territory he's best known for. Dedicated to his wife of four decades, Corrine Duke, who died 1 year ago, the album is laced with intimations of mortality. He signs off with a version of Happy Trails to You that leads Dale Evans right to church. Knowing now that he was fighting leukemia when he recorded the session, it's hard not to hear the song and the whole soul-drenched album as his farewell to us.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. Asians are the country's fastest-growing ethnic group, especially here in California. Case in point, the San Gabriel Valley, a majority Asian population east of Los Angeles. The food there is legendary for being some of the best Asian cuisine anywhere in Southern California. And a new event is bringing these culinary treats to a wider audience. Alex Schmidt headed out for a taste and brings us this story.
It's called 626 Night Market, named after the San Gabriel Valley's area code. About 200 stalls are set up in the huge grassy paddock area of the Santa Anita racetrack. As the sun sets, thousands of strolling guests nibble on street food. Matt Dickey and Jocelyn Ballou are digging in.
Yeah, we had a spiced egg.
That was new.
That was new.
That was good.
Yeah, it was,
everything's been good. We haven't tried anything that we didn't like.
Nothing's been bad. We had the chewy yam balls.
Oh, the yam balls were good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dickey and Ballou drove from Hollywood to taste Asian delicacies ranging from Chinese to Indonesian and Vietnamese. To find these foods in any other circumstance, they'd really have to know their way around a place that can feel different to outsiders, braving menus and signage without an English character in sight.
I think it's very intimidating for non-Asians to come to this area and order things and try out all the great restaurants and food. So, you know, we hope that this event could kind of be a bridge for that.
626 Night Market founder Johnny Huang immigrated from Taiwan to Kansas as a kid. At age 7, he moved to Monterey Park in the heart of the San Gabriel Valley.
We drove 2 weeks cross-country to Monterey Park, and I woke up in the car and I saw these Chinese signs everywhere, and I asked my mom, did we drive back to Taiwan or something?
That was 20 years ago, Huang says, and a lot of signage is still in Chinese. Monterey Park became the first suburban Chinatown after World War II, when an entrepreneur in Taiwan began marketing real estate there as the Chinese Beverly Hills.
They started to go there, and then you just had a snowball.
Dowell Myers is a professor of demography at USC. He says other Asian groups have since joined, and now the San Gabriel Valley includes Japanese, Vietnamese, and many other Asian communities.
It's definitely growing to the exclusion of other groups, and probably will continue to grow because they do have the money to buy what they need.
Similar things are happening across the country. Immigrants and minorities are moving to suburbs and creating large swaths of land that are not terribly diverse. The San Gabriel Valley is about 60% Asian, though Myers points out that within Asian communities, there is often a lot of diversity. He believes food can be a bridge that connects folks to these monolithic-seeming neighborhoods.
Food is what's most available from different cultures. It's being sold to other cultures. It's a superficial interaction because it's just you're just eating food. But I think it does make you more familiar with the words and more favorable to the idea of different cultures. So it's a starting point. It's not the end.
Back at the night market, the sun has gone down and the smells of foods are everywhere. Some are pleasant, but one particular smell I catch, not so much. The closest thing I can compare it to is sweaty feet. But no matter, it's time for me to sample some food myself.
All right, people have these skewers of grilled squid, and oh my god, here they are. The line is long, but I think I'm going to do it.
While waiting, I strike up a conversation with Teresa Kaufman. She's driven all the way here from Redondo Beach, about 40 miles, because the night market reminds her of her childhood.
I used to go to Taiwan and visit every summer, and the food, just kind of having that feeling of being in Taiwan and the night markets in Taiwan and missing it. It's really cool that they started it here.
Remember that smell I mentioned? Teresa let me taste the stinky tofu she was eating while we waited. Yup, that was it. I must admit I wasn't crazy about it, though I did love the squid skewers. Standing in line was worth it. I'd never tried fermented tofu and didn't know what a night market was really about. Food is just the beginning to understanding different cultures, but it's a tasty place to start. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt in the San Gabriel Valley.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Carly Naren and Rachel Marcus. The editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health happens in schools at calendow.org.